KQED.
From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Ann Packer's first novel, The Dive from Clawson's Pier, was an enormous critical and commercial success. In 2002, it shot up the bestseller list and netted enthusiastic reviews. The New York Times called it a humane novel that possesses at its center a searching emotional generosity. Now Packer is out with her second novel called Song Without Words, a story about the friendship between two women and what happens when their relationship is tested by near tragedy. A conversation with Bay Area novelist Ann Packer, next on Forum, after this. From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. The novel begins like this. Each evening, the streetlights came on at dusk, and the view out the window changed, from barely glowing kitchens and TV rooms to the houses that contained them and to the trees that sheltered the houses. It seemed to Sarah Beth that for a little while there was a kind of balance out there, an equilibrium. But then, quickly, darkness came down from the sky, and soon the rooms returned to prominence. And then finally, everything else was black, and the world seemed limited to a few bright lights on a street in Palo Alto. So begins Ann Packer's new novel, Songs Without Words, a story that charts the lifelong friendship of two women, a friendship born out of early family tragedy, and one that in time is tested again by family upheaval and by memory. It begins with the story of two teenagers, Sarah Beth, whose mother had committed suicide, and then goes to live across the street with her best friend Liz. The story then jumps ahead 25 years. Liz is now a mother of two who delights, somewhat guiltily, in the homemaking details of her suburban life. Sarah Beth is a home stager and a lampshade maker living in Berkeley, single, quirky, unsettled. The two women are still fast friends, but Liz's suburban tranquility is suddenly turned upside down, and Sarah Beth seems unable, for reasons both past and present, to respond. Packer's first novel, the critically acclaimed The Dive from Clawson's Pier, had what the New York Times called an utterly lifelike quality in its everyday detail. And in reading her work, you sometimes have the sense that the dialogue feels eerily familiar, words that you've heard sometime in your life. Ann Packer grew up in the Bay Area. It's where she still lives, and she joins us now. Ann Packer, good morning.
Good morning.
Happy to have you join us. You've said that you were surprised by the great success of The Dive from Clawson's Pier. How did that then prepare you for, or did it prepare you for, what would happen with the publishing of your second novel?
Well, the success prepared me for, it gave me knowledge of the different ways in which books can be received. And The Dive from Clawson's Pier was received in a way that was so far beyond my wildest dreams that, in a sense, I had to set it aside as I was writing this second novel, just from the awareness that these things aren't repeated in life and that I certainly couldn't attempt to repeat it, couldn't write the book so that, you know, I would bring that about. And had I tried that, I think I would have made myself very, very unhappy. So I had no idea what was going to happen when this book went out. I knew that I was lucky that there were some readers probably from last time who would be interested. And beyond that, you know, it really was unknown to me.
When you say it surprised or defied your expectations, did it defy your expectations in terms of the critical response or the commercial response or both?
Really both. It was lovely to get nice reviews. And I think that because it was my first book in almost a decade, it felt a little as if it were, you know, my actual debut, my first work of fiction at all. To have it become a bestseller and to have it do as well as it did, that was really what was most surprising. It hadn't seemed like that kind of book to me as I was writing it.
You also have said that you were surprised by how readers reacted to it and that they said, this was a book that I just couldn't put down. Are you surprised by that, about how people respond, or do you have a sense of what readers will do? You're the writer, but do you know the reader?
You really don't, and it's one of the most interesting and wonderful parts of the experience, really, is to find out for the first time how, you know, what happens on the other side of the page, how it is for the reader, what their experience is. And I get that early on in the process because I'm in a writer's group and I look to the friends who are in that group with me to give me feedback about what their experience of reading this is.
I was surprised reading one of the articles about your new novel that talked about how you got feedback from your writer's group and it affected in one way at least how one of the characters in the book, what his profession would turn out to be. Is that a common phenomenon? I guess I think of the novelist's pursuit being a solitary one. Is that abnormal to get that, to welcome that sort of feedback while you're writing?
I think not. Most writers I know have people who they really rely on to read their work. I think the number of readers can vary a lot. Some people rely on a spouse or perhaps an agent, an editor. Some rely on more people, for example, a group, as I do. But I think there are very few people who don't need to get a sense of what they've done. I mean, we often don't really know what we're about until we have someone describe it to us.
The themes of your two books in some ways have some common denominators. Die from Clausen's Pier was in part about a young woman split between her desire to stay loyal to her boyfriend who's paralyzed in a diving accident and being true to herself. And in some ways, Songs Without Words also is about how you remain loyal to a friendship, how you're torn sometimes from that. I'm curious about why that theme or that particular aspect of loyalty and friendship is so important to you.
I don't know that I can actually answer the question of why. I agree that it's very important to me. It seems as I look at this second book and at some of the, you know, the predominant themes, that there is a kind of almost obsessive going over this material that I'm doing and trying to sort of work out in fictional representations how different kinds of betrayal can look. And what interests me in particular is the way when we don't live up to our own standards for ourselves, the way we live with that and the way we think about ourselves because of that.
And are those based on your own experiences of friendship in particular, by your ability to observe that in other people? Because I think that's true. That's something we all worry about. Am I living up to being the best person, the best friend, the best mate that I can be?
I think partly it does come from my experience. There's no friendship in my history that resembles the friendship of Liz and Sarah Beth in the novel. But there are, I think, friendships that I've been in and friendships that I've observed in which people, the two parties, each take on a certain kind of role. And sometimes those roles tend to become confining and not all that useful anymore. And how do we successfully reframe the way we relate to each other? How do we sort of shake off the old roles and take on new ones that will help us, you know, have a fresher, more vibrant friendship in the future?
Are old friends particularly meaningful, do you think? I mean, both The Die from Clausen's Pier is about a relationship that begins early in life as young teens, as does the relationship in Songs Without Words. I think of this in part because I'm going to a high school reunion, I suppose, this weekend. But are those old friendships particularly intriguing to you about how they play out over time and what they wind up showing you about yourself?
I think they are. I think the power of old friendships comes from the fact that these people knew us at times when we were, you know, younger and you know, probably more vulnerable. And that gives them a kind of they know our story in some way, in the way that people we meet later in life perhaps don't. And that gives them a kind of a special quality. I think part of the need for friendship is the need to be known. And old friends can really fill that for us.
And do you know in the process of writing where that relationship is going to go, in the relationship between Sarah Beth and Liz? They start out as fast friends. In the middle of the book, something happens that pulls them apart. And then in the end, something else helps them again. Do you know where that's going when you're writing?
I know in a very general sense. Typically, I'm starting with a picture of people who are in relation to each other in a certain way. And I know that by the end, I want them to be in relation to each other in some other way. I don't know what they're going to say to each other and not say to each other over the course of the book to get to that end point, but I know that's where I'm going.
One of the things that you've been so acclaimed for is your ability to create such precise observational detail. It's reporter-like in a way. Where does that come from?
I think it just comes from watching the world very carefully. I was pretty shy as a child, and I think one of the ways I interacted with the world was to just pay very close attention to it and hold on to certain details that I saw, particularly details about people and the way they talked or gestured with their hands and the way they thought and, in a certain sense, moved around in the world.
I'm going to read just a short passage from one section fairly early in the book. This is the character Brody, Liz's husband, reflecting about the time that he and Liz had first lived together. It's just a short paragraph. It goes like this. He thought again of the apartment he and Liz had shared in San Francisco, the two small rooms, the tiny kitchen, the balcony with its narrow view of the bay. He remembered how strangely thrilled he was by his first sight of Liz's makeup in their shared medicine cabinet, how it seemed to prove something important. When I read that, I thought, that is exactly right. And yet I haven't had that experience. It's not like I remember the first time I lived with a woman seeing her makeup and thinking that. But it seemed, the detail of it seemed so real. There's no other word for it.
Thank you. I guess I am thinking when I'm writing a passage like that, very visually, and I'm trying to come up with the visual detail that will make the reader believe in Brody and believe in his memory at that moment in the present time of that important moment in the past.
And is that true for dialogue as well? I mean, one of the things about The Dive from Clawson's Pier was that the Carrie, the principal character in the book, is 23, as I recall, 24 at the time of the book. I happened to have read the book at the time my daughter was at the same age, and it seemed exactly right to me in the voice that it had, and similarly with the teenagers in this book. Is that also just by paying attention to how people talk, the rhythm in which they speak?
It is, and I wouldn't even want it to sound as if it were something that I have to work at or do work at.
You're not following around your children taking notes of how they
speak? Oh, no, I would never be allowed to do that. It's just kind of how my mind works. I'm fascinated by the way people talk, and I bring that fascination, I think, to my writing.
You've said that the character Lauren, who is the daughter of Liz in the novel and who's going through some difficult times without giving away too much of what happens in the book, but you've said that was the easiest character for you to write. And I'm curious about that because it would seem to me that writing in the voice of a very unhappy, depressed 15-year-old would not be an easy voice to capture.
I don't know why it was the case that she came so easily to me. What I really mean by that is that I wrote her sections in a quicker and less, if you will, agonized way. I mean, I think that writing Liz or writing Sarah Beth, there were moments when I paused and was thinking, you know, is this really the right direction? Is this the right voice? And I didn't have those doubts writing Lauren. It may be because she's so far away from me in life and in age that it came more smoothly. It may be that I really remember being 15, which I do. So I don't know how.
And do you draw from that memory of what it feels like to be a confused 15-year-old?
Absolutely.
So there's a little bit of Ann Packer in that.
Yes, there's, I think, more than a little bit of Ann Packer in poor, unfortunate Lauren.
The other component that obviously one knows about in reading about you and in reading the story is that Sarah Beth's mother committed suicide. That was an experience that you had in your own life with your father. Is that something, again, that informs how you write, the sensitivity with which you approach it? Or does it get in the way because it's something that is also part of your own family history?
It certainly doesn't get in the way. I think that my family history, from the great events to the small, all really by necessity inform my writing. And I think that the difficulties that my family went through when I was a child predisposed me to be interested in the effects of traumatic events and sort of even more so the aftermath and in finding ways to represent that in fiction.
Ann Packer, our guest this hour, her new novel is called Songs Without Words. It's, I think, I looked up, number 4 right now in the San Francisco Chronicle bestseller fiction list. It is doing well all around the country. The reviews have been mostly positive, but there have been some that have had some slings and arrows to them. Is that hard, especially after, you know, everyone was so wowed by The Dive from Clausen's Pier?
There's certainly a bit of a sting reading a negative review. As I've been sort of thinking it over, and what does this feel like and why is it feeling this way? Reviews are sort of a part of the publishing process. And one wants them to be positive more for their effect on potential readers and for the way in which a very positive review is going to invite people to go to a store and pick up the book and maybe buy it. And it's the relationship with the actual reader that matters most to me. It's certainly gratifying to read a super positive, nice review that seems to get what I was trying to do in the book. But to be approached by someone in a bookstore with that same kind of reaction and to hear, you know, on a personal level what the book meant to someone is far more gratifying, really.
Do you scratch your head when you read, as you may well have, I don't know, on the same day or back-to-back, a glowing review in, let's say, the Washington Post, as it was a glowing review, and then the review in your hometown paper, the San Francisco Chronicle, which was less glowing? Do you wonder what's going on? Are you able to distance yourself from it?
Well, I know what's going on. Reading is incredibly subjective, yeah. And there is no objective way to say how good a book is. I mean, it's sort of a silly idea. Different, you know, people bring so much to their readings of books, and I think sometimes things that we read or see get under our skin in ways that we may not even understand. And I think that can be at work as well.
And is that what's in play when you say someone comes up to you at a bookstore and says, I love this book? Is that what you feel is going on, that something about The Dive from Clausen Speer or something about Songs Without Words just touched the right nerve, just resonated something true and real for them?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, for me, reading fiction, reading wonderful novels and short stories, what's great about it is that it enlarges my sense of what it means to be human. And for me to be able to do something like that for someone else is just wonderful.
And does that then in turn what you want to continue to write? I mean, can you imagine writing, I don't know, a topic or a book that would take you apart from creating those sorts of relationships that are revealing about what it means to be human? Can you imagine writing a novel that wouldn't have that at its goal?
No, I can't really, because I can't imagine writing a novel that didn't directly relate to the things that matter to me about life.
And so it's all about relationships. I mean, there isn't going to be an Ann Packer novel that isn't about friendship, that isn't about the things that push and pull us and tell us more about who we are.
Well, never say never, but I can't quite picture what I would take on that would exclude, that to me, central part of life.
What are the challenges to you in doing that? I think I read that you went through 9 drafts of The Dive from Clausen Speer over almost a decade, right?
Yeah.
Is the act of writing that arduous? Is that part of how, or did this second one come more readily?
The first one came readily, and the second one came...
Just
slowly. And really, with the second novel, it took about 5 years. And it's not that it's arduous. It's that I love to revise, and I don't want to let the book go until I'm absolutely satisfied with it, until I feel that I've written the book that I wanted to write. And I'm a firm believer in the idea that when you first write a book, you're just beginning to get at what you're even trying to do. I remember hearing E.L. Doctorow speaking about this in a lecture. He said, I write in order to find out what I'm writing about. Hmm. And I think that that's very, very true for me as well. And to get it into the form that best tells the particular story that I want to tell. And that can involve a lot of work, tweaking the way characters behave to each other, changing things around so that something happens earlier rather than later in the novel, can have a huge effect on the meaning of the particular event.
Ann Packer, our guest this hour, her new novel is called Songs Without Words. When we return, we'll welcome your participation in our conversation as well. If you have questions for Ann Packer, you can join us now. We'll open up the phone lines. Here's the number. It's 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Or you can email us your thoughts at forum@kqed.org. That's forum@kqed.org. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our guest this hour, Ann Packer, her new novel, Songs Without Words. And we welcome your participation in our conversation as well. You can call us now at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, or you can email us at forum@kqed.org. Before the break, Ann Packer, you were talking some about the amount of work it takes to get it right. And does it also require, then, a certain degree of discipline? I remember reading once that Wallace Stegner said that he wrote every day. Someday it might only be a couple of sentences, but you had to write every day. Is that true for you as well?
It's not true for me. I used to have beliefs about what I had to do in order to be a writer, and the sort of the conditions I needed in order to be able to write. And I found after my daughter was born that if I had an hour, I could use it. And that remains true to this day. There are days when I head out to my office as soon as my kids have gone to school and I work for 6 hours. And there are days when I don't work at all. And, you know, it's certainly true that if you go a long time period, you know, weeks, it can feel a little difficult to get back into it, sort of like resuming an exercise routine after you have been sedentary for a long time.
And can you get stalled in that process? Just as sometimes you get stalled as a reader. I mean, is there a point where you think, this just isn't working, I've got to set it aside?
Sure. There are things that I've put aside because I've kind of run into a wall with them, or more likely run out of interest. That's something that I thought was going to hold my attention and be fun to do no longer was.
And can you sense when you're having a real problem? I would say, for example, for me, in my just everyday reader experience of reading Songs Without Words, that I love the first 100 pages, that then it got a little slower for me, and then it really picked up again, and I thought it ended wonderfully. Can you sense that? I'm now asking you to predict how I read the book, which isn't a fair question, but I'm just curious about whether or not you can see rhythm, I guess, within your own book, and when you think, boy, it needs a shove. I need to sort of push this forward so that it has momentum.
I think a lot about rhythm and pacing, and some of the events in the middle of the book are, I think, more painful than those at the beginning and those at the end.
And maybe it's also because you're wanting something to happen. There's this sort of impasse in the middle of the book where things just aren't progressing, either for Lauren, the child, or for the relationship, the friendship between. And maybe that's it. Maybe I wanted to have them resolve that.
It could be. And I felt my job as the writer was to find a way to represent change that was realistic. And unfortunately, as we all know, change happens very slowly.
Yeah. Yeah.
On the other hand, you know, I didn't want it to be boring.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's right, that it has to take over time. And that's sort of the sense you have of it, that they have to work through these things. Lauren has to get to the better place. It's not something that's going to happen with a pill or a magic counseling session. To our callers this morning, John joins us first on the Sirius Satellite Network from North Bergen, New Jersey. John, go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you.
Good. I want to ask the author if she ever experiences writer's block and how she handles it.
You know, I don't actually experience something that I would call writer's block. I certainly have moments when the writing isn't going well, and I think, oh, God, now what? The best advice I've ever heard about writer's block is essentially lower your standards. And I think if you're really, really, really stuck, it can be good to take yourself out of the work that's troubling you and just write something else for a while, just to, you know, free yourself up from that kind of paralyzed state.
Is that helpful, John?
Yeah, we have I just recently went to a book signing over here. There was an author that lives in this area. His name's Michael McGowan. And he actually, I met him at the book signing, and he said that he has to drink every day to write. And he said he actually, there's a website dedicated to him, alcoholicwriter.com. and he says once he sobers up, he can't write anymore.
I don't know if we're going to get a further endorsement of that strategy, but John, thanks. Thanks
okay.
for the call.
Yeah, I would have to say that would be pretty much the end of it for me.
When we were talking a moment ago about how you sustain forward momentum and rhythm, is it musical in a way to you then? Is that sort of in terms of the rhythm of writing?
It is. That's a great metaphor. There's on the sentence level, on the chapter level, on the level of the entire book, there's a feeling of phrasing that resembles music quite closely. And if I'm writing and am monkeying around with some sentences. I do think, you know, should there be a rest here? I don't necessarily think in those words, but that's sort of how it sounds to my ear.
You're talking a moment ago about how change takes time, and for someone who is in a difficult point in life to move beyond that is not something that can happen magically. And one of the moments in the book that again struck me as so real and so right, and in some ways seemed significant, was when Lauren is in this difficult stage, the young daughter, 15-year-old, and she goes out with her father to run a bunch of errands. And halfway through the errands trip, Brody, the father, hands the car keys to Lauren and says, "Want to drive?" And somehow it struck me on several levels that it was part of it as a parent. It struck me as, way to go, exactly the right thing. I'm just curious about where that came from. And if you also felt like it was a significant sort of shift in Lauren's beginning to sort of go forward, drive forward, if you will.
It was a significant shift for her, and also really for her relationship with her father and for the way her father was thinking about her. Up until that time, he's been somewhat scared of her and has come to a realization in a scene not long before the one that you're talking about that somehow he hasn't helped her enough. And in this scene in the parking lot when he hands her the keys, he hasn't thought about it beforehand.
Right.
But because of the thoughts he'd had in the previous scene, he was ready to discover a way to help her.
Our caller next is in Santa Rosa. Go ahead, please. Waits.
Yes, so this is Waits in Santa Rosa. In interest of full disclosure, I know Ann Packer's mother, Nancy Packer. We're both from Birmingham, Alabama. And my question is this. I know Nancy taught creative writing at Stanford University, and I know that Ann's brother, George Packer, is a writer for the New York Times, and it's also published a number of successful books. And I'm just wondering how that family history fits into her life arc to becoming a writer.
Waits, thanks. Thanks for the call and observation. You do come from that writing family, as Waits describes, not only your mother teaching, but your brother George writing for The New Yorker. How did that play out for you? In some ways, I've heard that it made you less enthusiastic about becoming a writer initially.
Well, yeah, initially, and I suppose by initially, I mean, when I was seven. I really wasn't interested in being a writer. I was aware, observing my mother and her colleagues at Stanford and her students and friends, that it's a very hard life. It's certainly a hard way to make a living. We know that. And it can be it can be torture for some people. And I think I saw that more than any joy. And that may, you know, say more about my way of experiencing the world than anything else. But to me, it seemed a little bit, it was off-putting in some sense.
Does it bring you joy now?
Oh, so much. I love it. I'm incredibly lucky that I get to do this because it's a huge pleasure.
Lynn writes in, my question is, how did Anne find her writer's group? As a writer, I've tried classes, workshops, and even looking for writing partners. How do you find that group?
Well, I was very, very lucky. The group that I'm in existed prior to my joining it, and I was friendly with a number of the members and quite close friends with one of them, and I just said, you know, if you guys ever have an opening, I think I would like to join, and they very kindly made room for me. So I kind of walked into it. There are a number of ways, though, to get to a group. I think that the hard thing is to find people you can trust and people who will neither simply say, oh, you know, it's so wonderful, nor take a knife to your work or to you. It's really a balance of a sensitive reading that has, you know, as its central aim, figuring out what you're doing and trying to help you come up some ways with some ways to do it better.
Do you have to be tough? You talked about not finding someone who wants to take a knife to your work. But when you read a critical review, even if you're an acclaimed and successful novelist, do you still have to have thick skin?
It helps. I think it depends on what you're reading the review for. If you're reading it to bolster your own sense of yourself as a writer, or to feel something about the book that you haven't felt yet, then I think a thick skin can be really vital. I think there's another way to read reviews, which is simply, you know, to find out what's going out there, what's in the newspapers around the country that that readers might read, and from that point of view, if you're curious, again, as I was saying earlier about the reviews of this book, you might feel a little sting reading something terribly negative, especially if it seems somehow not to take seriously the fact that you've written this book and that you've spent a lot of time working on it. A dismissive review, I think, mm-hmm. can be tough to take. But you move on.
Ann Packer, our guest this hour. Again, her new novel is called Songs Without Words, and we welcome your calls and thoughts as well. You can join us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, or you can email us at forum@kqed.org. We were talking a moment before about the father, Brody, doing the right thing by handing the car keys to Lauren. And I'm wondering about the role of parenthood in your writing. There's an anxiety about parents, contemporary parents, that also comes through in this book. Liz worries a lot about whether or not she's done the right thing and whether or not she's responsible. Is that something that intrigues you, the sort of anxious parents?
It intrigues me, and it has me. I am an anxious parent.
Yeah.
I think that the responsibility we feel for the well-being of our children is quite awesome in a sense. It's huge. And I think what intrigues me is that with the best of intentions, we can still miss what's going on with our kids. There can be some real trouble brewing that parents, despite, you know, being observant and aware and wanting to be in the child's life, can just not know about. And that intrigues and terrifies me.
Is that something you think you'll write more about?
I would think I probably will, yeah.
I want to read something else from the novel that has to do not so much with parenthood, but another observational moment that has to do with, well, perhaps it does in terms of the plethora of anxiety perhaps that there is in the Bay Area. But it's a comparison that, again, the character Brody makes between living in the Bay Area and where he grew up, which was in the Midwest. And it goes like this. It was late November, sunny and clear and 60 degrees, a day the Midwest could not fathom. The bay was blocks away, the ocean just on the other side of the mountains, the country's most beautiful city a half hour north. All of this Brody knew. This is why we live here, people said at all times of the year. This is why we wouldn't live anywhere else. But was it more dangerous here in the Bay Area, where it was so beautiful and so temperate? What if he'd stayed in the Midwest, where hardship came every year in the form of frozen pipes and cars that wouldn't start and months of cabin fever? Did a certain kind of ease pave the way for trouble? I think of that as someone who, like you, also lived for a time in the Midwest. Curious about your feelings about that and whether or not you believe that, whether or not there's a certain ease about the Bay Area that paves the way for trouble.
I don't think that myself. I don't think that ease necessarily paves the way for trouble. I think it can make trouble more upsetting. If we haven't struggled a lot, and here I think, you know, it's an important distinction between sort of physical struggle, the struggle with cold weather that we might have in Madison, Wisconsin, for example, and emotional trouble. I think Brody in this moment is really trying to explain to himself what's going on in his life. And he's trying to figure out if he should have known that it was coming. And I think that that for me is an interesting theme in the book and in life, that we want to account for the bad things that happen to us. And so often, retrospectively, we look for hints, you know, oh, I should have known.
And doesn't Liz at one point not only talk about not that she should have known, but that somehow she wants to explain it. Somehow she wants it to be her fault, because that at least makes it understandable instead of this mystifying thing that comes out of nowhere.
Understandable, and also it makes her less helpless. If, for example, Lauren's problems were her fault, Liz's fault, as if something could be reduced to that, then she wasn't just standing around with absolutely no ability to affect events.
Our callers are back with us. Lynn in Green Bay joins us. Lynn, go ahead.
Oh, hi. I just wanted to first make a statement. I'm enjoying the book so much, but I'm sleep deprived because I've had to stay up and read it for three nights running. But I love it. And I wanted to know, Anne, if you have any personal knowledge of suicide, since it makes a couple of appearances in the book, and also any comments on how the canoe makes a couple of appearances in the book. Thank you for
Lynn,
my answer.
Lynn, thanks for the call. We touched on it, Lynn, before perhaps you joined the program, about Anne's experience with that. But
yeah, I lost a parent to suicide myself, as does Sarah Beth in the novel. And I think that the theme of suicide that runs through the book interests me in particular because of the ways that these things echo through life. And Sarah Beth looks at her childhood and her loss of her mother as a kind of almost a shadow that she's been living under for a long time. And part of what the book is about is the question of, is there some way to get out from under that? As far as the canoe goes, I'm not sure I quite understand what the question is.
As I recall, at least in the novel, there's a point where Sarah Beth has a relationship and looks like she might get involved with a man in the book who at one point says, let me show you my canoe. So perhaps our caller is asking whether there's some magical significance in the canoe.
Yeah, and I'm sure that there's some way to interpret it beyond, you know, is sometimes a canoe is just a canoe. The canoe brings Sarah Beth into a relationship with a married man, Mark, that that has the danger for her of going beyond platonic and into something else. And so there's some sense of, I think, portent in that particular scene.
Do you feel like at times you have to, is that part of the craft of writing, of adding something like that in to have, to, so that the reader wonders what's going to happen next, literally, that you, I wonder what's going to happen here, that part of your job is to make sure, as we were talking about before in terms of pacing, that every now and again you give them a little nibble of something that may or may not play out, but you want to know how it's going to play out.
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's a central part of the novelist's job, I think, to create questions. I think we read in order to find out the answer to questions we may not actually know we have. But in this example that we're talking about with Sarah Beth and the canoe, the question might be, what's going to happen with this guy? And that's one of the questions in the reader's mind that carries him or her forward. And of course, in a novel, there are dozens of questions.
What are you reading right now?
Right now I'm reading The Line of Beauty by Alan Hollinghurst. Started it on an airplane sometime in the last couple of weeks. I can't actually say when. And it's just beautifully written. The sentences are extraordinary. I was in New York at my publisher's office last week and was given a galley of the new Sue Miller novel, The Senator's Wife, and it was a great pleasure to read that as I was traveling as well.
I like Sue Miller's novels a lot. Do you find it? Are there writers that you feel like you have something in common with that are kindred spirits, perhaps in either the way they write or the themes that they go after?
Oh, sure, yeah. I think that I'm drawn to other writers who are working this particular vein of domestic life and the disturbances that can happen at home, so to speak. And by domestic, I don't just mean within one house, but among friends as well. The writer who I think of all the time as being just sort of splendid and a great inspiration, and most writers I know feel this way, is Alice Munro.
Also a short story writer, which is what your first book was about. Do you want to go back to the short story? Is that a particular form that you're still drawn to?
I love the form of the short story. In fact, my next book will be a novella, which is what I'm working on right now, and several stories.
What can you tell us about that? Or can you tell us about that?
I can. I can talk a little about the novella because I'm far enough along with it. It actually is set here in the Bay Area also, and specifically on the Stanford campus in the early 70s. And the main character is a 13-year-old boy whose life is disrupted by the arrival of a family with a very charismatic father and also a very charismatic 13-year-old girl.
Is it tougher? Seems like an obvious question, but let me ask it anyway. To write about the opposite sex, to write in the character and the voice of a boy or a man. Your principal characters in your two novels, at least, have been women. Brody seems, the husband of Liz in the book, completely real and right to me. But is that a particular challenge?
It is a little more, how do I put this, unnatural, I suppose. I think when I'm writing a male character, particularly when I'm writing in the first person, I'm a little more questioning of what I'm doing than I would be with a female character. With a female character, I'm more likely to write without slowing down over that kind of thing.
And what about how you write about the role of women in contemporary life? As I mentioned in the introduction, Liz seems to be this person who really is happy being the suburban mom, feels a tad guilty about that, but says at one point, well, you know, should I apologize or should I feel bad about the fact that this is what I like? Is that a theme that you're also interested in and would like to continue to explore?
It is. I find the national conversation about what women do to be really interesting, and particularly interesting is the passion with which people who have made one choice sometimes talk about people who have made the opposite choice. That I find fascinating.
Well, and it takes us back in some ways to, you know, Hillary Clinton's famous, should I have stayed home and baked cookies back in the 92 presidential campaign.
Yeah, those cookies caused a lot of trouble, didn't they?
Is that something that you wrestle with in your own life as a mother of two teenagers and a writer?
Well, I'm sort of doing both. You know, I'm very much, quote unquote, home with my kids. And I'm also working. No, I don't wrestle with the choices that I've made. I feel, as I was saying a while back, very, very lucky that I get to write and to be home with my kids.
In the end, we began our conversation by talking about the difference between writing and reading, and that you never really know how readers will necessarily respond. But I'm curious, finally, about what your hopes are as a writer for what readers will experience, whether it's reading Songs Without Words, A Dive from Clausen's Pier, or your upcoming novella. What it is that you hope the words that you write, the detail with which you write them, the truth with which you try to get the sound of a particular voice or character, what you hope readers will draw from that?
I hope that readers will feel they are living among real people when they're reading my work, and that what happens in the book and the ways in which I represent life will make something happen in another person's mind, essentially, is what I'm really hoping for, whether it be a flood of memory or a series of hopes for the future or just a sense of the variety of human experience.
Anne Packer, her new novel is called Songs Without Words. Pleasure to have you on our program this morning. Thank you.
Thank you.
Forum is produced by Robin Giannatasio-Mall and Kevin Guillory. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Engineer is Danny Bringer, and the executive producer of Forum is Raul Ramirez. Next week on Forum with Michael Krasny, the topic is Darfur on Monday, and then later in the week, another novelist joins us, and Patchett will join Michael Krasny on Wednesday of next week. Some of what's coming up next week on Forum. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.